Welcome to the University of Chicago Public Policy Podcasts. This is UC3P, our eponymously named podcast on policy, politics, and current affairs. My name is David Raban, and I'm the production manager for what we like to call the main page. Today, we finish our limited run miniseries, Gun Violence, the Other Epidemic. In this episode, you'll hear from Dr. Jeffrey Butts, professor of criminal justice and director of the Research and Evaluation Center at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Given his title, you might have thought he'd talk to us about prosecution or incarceration. Instead, he talked to us about approaching gun violence as a public health issue.
Dr. Butts, thank you so much for being on UC3P.
Sure, happy to join you.
I want to begin by asking you to tell us more about your work with the Community-Based Violence Prevention Program.
So that was a number of years ago. That was a federal grant to test the impact of federally funded programs to reduce youth violence. And the research challenge was the federal government handed out grants to a number of cities and then exercised very little control over what the modality would be. So we were forced to basically, instead of having a cross-site evaluation, we had a multi-site evaluation of slightly related but varying strategies.
You released a paper about a program called Cure Violence. Can you tell me what are the key ideas behind the approaches of Cure Violence?
So Cure Violence is, people call it the public health approach to violence reduction because it's an attempt to reduce violence using community resources rather than rely on the coercive power of the state through policing, law enforcement, and punishment. Americans love punishment, and it's really hard to change the frame if you're saying we're going to reduce violence without calling the police. We're going to organize the community itself to reduce violence. So it's a challenge politically. But the core ideas are there are enough people in any neighborhood to help reduce violence. They just need to form attachments and relationships with the people most inclined to commit violence and try to, through relationships, dissuade them from behaving that way. And that means hiring people to hang out in neighborhood parks, to be on the street, and to people who know the neighborhood, and to talk to, unfortunately, what we're talking about is usually young males. So the older people sometimes behave violently and females sometimes, but I think we all know the vast majority are young men. And so this project that we did focused on 18 to 30-year-old males, and we worked in a number of neighborhoods around New York and evaluated the impact of these programs. And the basic strategy is, so I mentioned hanging out in the parks and forming relationships. Those positions are called violence interrupters. And there's a good film you can look at called The Interrupters. It was made about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, that follows some of these people around in Chicago and watches them talk to people and sort of try to work their magic. And I use the word magic, and that means it's hard. You can't turn off a behavioral trajectory just by chatting up someone and pointing out to them that violence is bad and it's going to end up bad for them too. It's tough. But one key thing that Cure Violence believes is the best people to do that are people who know the neighborhood, who know the life, who aren't judgmental, know the language, know all the slang. And that means you got to come from that neighborhood. You can't hire some white kid from up by Northwestern and send them into a neighborhood on the south side of Chicago and say, hey, get to know people, try to influence their behavior. So you need to hire people from the neighborhood. And that means you're hiring people that themselves have grown up and often disadvantaged. They may have been involved in violence themselves. They may have been involved in a street crew or clique of some kind, maybe have gone away and done a period of incarceration and now they're home. Those are exactly the kind of people you want to hire. But that means you have to work with them to support them. It's not just like you hire someone, give them a paycheck and set them loose. You have to develop their capacity to do that job, and that takes time. But if it's done well, it's an incredibly powerful asset for a community to have because they know about things happening in the neighborhood that police will never know. And you can't just squander that resource by closing down a program if you don't like it. You have to really build it up and sustain it over time.
Can you give me a sense of how the implementation of a Cure Violence approach works on the ground? So who are some of the key stakeholders that are involved, and which groups do you work with to implement the program?
Gary Slutkin, who's still the director of this organization, was on a faculty position at UIC, and realized that he needed to help start something and have a model, have an approach that could be systematized or replicated in various places. And so the key thing in building a program is, as I just explained, hiring the right people. Then you need to have a physical location in the neighborhood. So again, you don't want an office in the Loop trying to serve neighborhoods on the south side. You need to have a neighborhood presence. The best place is a small storefront that's on a heavily trafficked street. So often it was a place that used to be a dry cleaner or a bodega of some kind, and you lease it. You put branding on the front window, so as people walk by, they see what it is. They get to know it. They become familiar with the storefront and the people who work there. And then you need some organizational effort, so you need to hire a supervisor or a manager. And in addition to the violence interrupters, there's also a category of employee called outreach workers, which are kind of like traditional social workers or community organizer or caseworkers. Their job is, after the interrupters have formed a relationship, I mean, let's make up a case, and let's say there's a kid called AJ who lives on the south side and has been in a street crew, often has a pistol in his pocket, and is at high risk for either being victimized or victimizing someone else with violence. The violence interrupters learn about AJ, find him, make friends with him, talk about their lives, hang out in the park, let him know over time that they can be trusted. And that's the end of their job in terms of making the attachment and keeping tabs on AJ and his friends and sort of keeping their ear to the ground to hear about things. Then the outreach worker comes along, is introduced by the violence interrupter, and the outreach worker talks to AJ about what his life is like. So maybe AJ is 18. Maybe he doesn't have a high school equivalency. So they ask him if he would like to do that. They help him make connections with a program which would give him his high school equivalency. Then they talk about employment and what he needs, and they sort of attach him to a work opportunity. And as you probably know, getting people from disadvantaged communities in the labor market is no small feat. First of all, they're excluded. The labor market often doesn't want them. And so they have to learn the skills to sort of climb that mountain by themselves. And so the outreach workers work with them to try to get them ready for the labor market and capable of holding on to a job. And all the time that's happening, they're dealing with other life challenges. Where does AJ live? Is he at home? Was he living with his grandmother and now has been kicked out because he got arrested? Is he couch surfing? Is he homeless? And they deal with those situations. So you just try to introduce some stability into his life. And none of those things are easy. Social structures often are a deterrent to helping people like this kid, AJ. So you spend time, you make the effort, you act in his interest.
Can we talk about causal effects? Do we know what the causal effects are? Do we have good evidence for those? Basically, the bulk of the question is cure violence working?
We know from our own research and from the literature so far that this is not a magic solution. It doesn't solve all violence problems, but it can have a significant effect. So in a neighborhood, just pick, I don't know if Woodlawn is still a good example in Chicago, but say AJ lives in Woodlawn and you learn his friendship network and you start working with them, and pretty soon you've got 30 or 40 young men that you're working with, and you go back 2 years later and in that neighborhood there are, say, 10 fewer shootings than the five-year trend prior, and of those, three were typically homicides. So you can, through post hoc statistical analysis, start to see, if you do this in multiple neighborhoods, what if in each of these neighborhoods you reduce fatalities due to gunfire by three? From a citywide perspective, that doesn't seem critical. In a neighborhood, though, that could be profound. And three averted homicides in just raw cost-benefit terms can save enough money due to the reduction in social harm to pay for that program. Each of these programs might cost $500,000 a year to house in a neighborhood. And four homicides would pay for it, the whole program. The trick is that money is hypothetical. It's based upon analysis. No alderman, city council person, mayor can see their budget sheet and see the numbers coming out of the budget or coming back into the budget from savings. And so it takes sustained discussion and evidence to slowly turn them to realize that it could be a good investment for them. Using the term good evidence is the first challenge. And I say this a lot when I'm working with practitioners and policymakers, that it's, I guess I can't avoid the word naive. It's naive for people to look at published literature and take all the studies you can find, rank them on rigor and design, find the top five and say, that's what works. And yet that's exactly what people do all the time. And if you do that in the field of violence and crime prevention. What you end up with at the top of that list, not coincidentally, is a bunch of therapeutic individualized intervention models, because that's where you get good effects. That's where you get statistical power. If your model says, I can prevent violence by talking to young people alone in a room, one-on-one counseling for an hour a week, you can measure that really easily. And if the definition of the case or the unit of analysis is an individual and their behavior, you can do a decent job of getting effects back, even if your actual impact is not that profound. So, you know, statistical power is a combination of the overall effect you're accomplishing, the variance that you're looking at. And it's just easier to do that with a model that focuses on individuals. If your model, however, says you reduce violence at the community level, and you do so while protecting the anonymity of all the people you're talking to, you don't write down their names, you don't even know their names sometimes. That AJ I made up, that might be the only thing you know about him. His nickname is AJ, and he lives somewhere in the neighborhood, but you don't know his address, you don't know his birth date, you don't know anything about him. If that's the model, you can't do individual level change. You have to do community level change, which is what I just described, going back after 3 years and finding a reduction of 3 shootings or 5 shootings. You don't get much power, much statistical power from that kind of analysis, unless you had 50 neighborhoods, and no one so far has been able to afford a study, a pre-post study even, of 50 neighborhoods. So mostly what we do, and I'll tell you, we did one component of our research on cure violence was actually a true pre-post. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation asked us to study cure violence and actually amazingly gave us funding and asked us to participate with Gary Slutkin and his program in locating the new programs. So we were able to go to the neighborhoods where we knew they were about to have a cure violence program, start collecting data, start interviewing 18 to 30 year old males, and we had a true pre-intervention wave of data collection. That almost never happens. Usually it's all post hoc. You know that the program's been up and running in this one neighborhood for 5 years. You go look at their official data on policing and look retrospectively and see if you can detect a change using some kind of interrupted time series or difference-in-difference model. And those kind of analyses are never going to be able to compete with random controlled trials at the individual level. If you're talking to, and that's why I use the word naive, if you're talking to some state legislator or a member of Congress or OMB or someone, they're just going to say, is that an RCT? Did you do a random assignment study? And if you say no, it's post hoc interrupted time series, you're out. You're out of the room. And that's a huge problem for policy, that we have this standard we use, which predisposes policymakers to focus on individual level interventions rather than community level change, because it's harder to get the statistical power you need to persuade people.
So building on that question then, what role does state, local, and even national government play in helping implement policies like this?
I think if you have to build relationships over time. So me just using the word naive assumes that you don't have a relationship with the person. That let's say that there's a chief of staff from the chair of the Appropriations Committee in your state. That person, that chief of staff, needs to be educated enough and smart enough and interested enough to listen, to read, to start to develop an understanding of this. It helps if they have a good MPP from a good school, because they're maybe more prepared to talk like that. But then they have to persuade the elected official that the research is persuasive enough to establish a high probability of costs or benefits that outweigh the costs. And that comes from, again, from building relationships with people. So your podcast is part of that. Briefings on the Hill. People have regular briefings. I did one once, or went to one, and it was mostly staff people. The elected officials tend not to go to those, but I think that's fine. If you can continually refresh your relationships with the senior staff and help them understand the situation, they will persuade the electeds to do the right thing. But you cannot just focus on elected officials, because they turn over so quickly and their interests are sometimes completely detached from public interests, public safety, good policy. So you have to focus on the staff. And I think the way to do that is not obvious or not easy. It takes sustained effort. I once worked on a foundation project called Key Decision Makers, where this foundation spent a lot of money flying people around the country to go to conferences, and they focused on elected officials. And you could just see the effect drain away after a few years as all those people went on to other things or got defeated in the next cycle. It's frustrating, but that's democracy. And I think we just have to have a sustained investment in developing relationships with staff and educating them on the issues.
What would you say is the role for state and national government grants in programs like this?
I wish it were evidence driven. It's not. I've been doing this a long time. So you went through my CV there, and I can tell you my first job in the field of crime and justice was in 1980, which tells you that I'm getting up there. But having done almost four decades now in this field, it's always a fight. It's always a battle. There's always a new crop of enthusiastic true believers in the latest fad. And you'll have things like mentoring, for example, in the youth justice area. Mentoring is a good idea. It's connecting a young person who doesn't have a good pro-social adult in their lives with such a person and helping them. I mean, we all survived because someone in our lives, when we were 14 years old, someone cared about us and someone helped steer us in a direction that we pursued. And every young person needs that. And so mentoring at its root is a good idea. But the federal government poured so much money into mentoring from the 90s, even into the Obama administration, that it was far out of proportion to a useful investment portfolio. If we had a truly evidence-driven policy structure, we would balance our investments. So it's kind of like some money you put into safe bonds, others you do speculative market investments. We would do the same thing with research. That mentoring, fine. It's a good model. It's a proven model within some limitations. You make some investments in that. But everyone during those years was rushing around to get in on the mentoring bandwagon, and they spent so much money on it, it just became ridiculous. And then you have grantees out in the field, either practitioners, programs, or researchers, who are primarily interested in getting the grant. And so if they get a sense that the federal government only cares about mentoring, well, guess what kind of proposals you're going to get? And it just becomes this predictive repeating cycle. So I wish I could be more confident that the role of public officials at the state and federal level is a positive thing and they helped create new evidence. But usually we're fighting with them to have them see the need for a diversity of investments. And that means someone has to ride in on their horse and convince the masses that they need to look at this new idea, this new program. And then they need research partners who are good enough to back them up and do research on the model as it's being developed. If it's an emerging program, you need a different kind of personality. You need a researcher who is almost anti-authoritarian or questioning of authority, who's willing to challenge conventional wisdom and invest their time and their career in a new idea. And most academics are not like that. Most academics want to get in the best journals, pump out a series of articles, get promoted. And that means investing their time in something safe with a high probability of return on that investment. So it's a tricky business to develop new ideas in a way that can produce public safety more in a cost-effective way using the most innovative ideas. It's not simple.
For my last question, I want to take a step back and look at something a bit broader. How do solutions like Cure Violence work within the national conversation that we're having about gun violence here in the United States?
I think in that way, I'm a little more optimistic that the conversation is changing somewhat. I think we still have the problem of the public's attention and the politics focusing on mass shootings. And of course, we need to pay attention to mass shootings, often defined as a shooting involving three or more victims. But when you look across the number of people, even the number of people killed through homicide, mass shootings is somewhere in the low double digits in terms of the prevalence. When you look at people killed by guns, mass shootings are in these low single digits because most people killed by guns are either suicides or homicides, domestic violence situations, or what we think of as typically street crime. I think Cure Violence and its presence in the national discussion is starting to make people realize that we will never be able to predict where shootings happen. And all the political interest behind background checks and all that stuff, it's helpful and it's necessary, but you can't predict everybody's behavior. You don't know who the person is just with hatred and anger brewing that is going to grab a gun the next time. So you need something that's broader. And the public health analogy that people make most often is smoking. I bet neither of you guys in that studio are about to fire up a cigarette sitting in that building. We just don't do that anymore. You don't think about smoking, certainly in a public building or a campus, public transit. We just don't do it anymore because we've changed the norms. And part of the norm change did involve local ordinances that would fine you for smoking when you're not supposed to. But that's not why people continue to refrain from smoking. We changed the expectation that smoking is something you do outside. And then we established a norm that smoking is not good for you. It's not cool. And that took 60 years, basically, to change the way the public thinks about cigarette smoking. But you do that through social norms, education, and changing the context in which behavior is acceptable. And that's public health. And so if we can do that with guns and gun violence, I think more and more people, even if you talk to your average person who has a teenager at home, they recognize that it's not just about setting rules and delivering consequences. They do want sensible things that help discourage behavior. And that's public health. And so Cure Violence is trying to articulate that as an approach to gun violence. And I do hear more, it's gaining more resonance among state, local, even federal officials. But it's not something that changes overnight, just like cigarettes. It takes a couple decades, but I think we're on the path.
All right. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're very welcome.
And that's a wrap on another episode of UC3P. Credits go to Arjun Mota for producing and engineering, and Siddhant Wadera for interviewing and editing. Our assistant production managers are Arjun Mota, Olu Ogidan, Soumya Karun, and Siddhant Wadera. Our finance director is Donovan Harvey. Our publisher is Yining Wong. Communications assistance came from Jordan Mahome. Our intro music is Knockout 2 by The Tubi, and our outro music is Yes, Yes, Y'all by Matt Large. This episode featured the track From Sunrise to Sunset by Matt Large. Our cover art was designed by Shirin Raban. If you want to hear more podcasts, check out our website, uc3p.org. And if you want to contact us, our email is theuc3p@gmail.com. Please remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And when you do, scroll to the bottom of the feed and give us a 5-star rating. It might be a small act to you, but giving us a 5-star rating really helps us reach more listeners who are just like you. Thank you. My name is David Raban, and stay tuned. We'll be back next week to talk about love in this crazy, crazy time. That's right, we're back on Friday with Naked Love. I started recording in case we could get a blooper. So you have anything funny to say, Olu? Because I think Arjun needs to get out of here. You have 4 seconds to be funny. 3, 2.
What happened when the beaver ran into a wall?
Damn.
We already did this one with Soumya, and then it didn't record.
That sounds right.
That's ridiculous. I can't believe you just said that.
I love that that's just in your back pocket, apparently, for any time you need to be on cue for something. That's absurd. All right.
That might be the best blooper of all time.
Great.